Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Consider This. Today I'm going to be speaking to Shahril Sabaruddin. He's senior fellow at think tank Bayt al-Amanah. We're in Johor, and going to be talking specifically about constructing policy for young people in the state of Johor. Shahril, very interesting that almost all parties, there's a consensus that young people are important to them as a voter base, but also that in some sense, all the issues of economic recovery, sustainability, has to target this particular demographic, right? It is the future, as it were. So, but before we get into that, I'd like to ask you a little bit about Bayt al-Amanah itself as a think tank. And what its orientation for people who are not familiar with the think tank. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Hi, Sharad. Thank you so much. Okay, so Bayt al-Amanah, we started institutionalizing in 2014 during the time when Dato' Sri Khalid Nordin was the Chief Minister of Johor, primarily to serve the interests of the state in terms of developing policies for the state, in terms of deriving the right mechanism for political communication, for government effectiveness and stuff like that. So we worked right at the center of government to deliver these kind of aspirations from the government aspect down to the people. Of course, after PRU14, we started to branch out a little bit to do some other things with some other stakeholders, but our primary interest is still in policy development. So one of our core specific focus is on democracy itself. So if you notice, our name are sometimes being quoted together with Bersih, also with ideas in some of their statements, primarily advocating a better Malaysia in terms of democratic attainment, the need for recall elections, the need for better representation in terms of redelineations, better political reform and stuff like that. Some of these are agendas that we kindly, closely pursue to push the agenda moving forward. And we see things are pretty, moving slowly but surely in the right way. That what we can see evidently in the Johor State election, every political party really latches on to political reform this time around, partly is because of this, to kind of allude to this particular group of people who are very much idealistic but now has that power on the stroke of their pen.
Right. So that's interesting because often, issues of political reform were associated with the more liberal end of the spectrum in terms of Malaysian voters. It was seen as a middle class kind of issue and not related necessarily to broader questions of economic inclusion, employment or employability. Youth unemployment, of course, is a huge issue, especially for those with tertiary education. How do those things connect? And do you have a sense of the ways, not just of how political stakeholders are making the connection, but also in the minds of young people, they are making a connection between democratization and also economic security?
See, because primarily the data that I derive is from social media. So the sentiment in social media sometimes could be very shallow in terms of the interpretation of the individual dimensions of understanding of specific issue. It could rather easily be simplified to just blaming whoever is in power due to, that is actually the reason for their economic circumstances or their social problems. So that's loud in social media. But also understanding this core demography is important. Understanding why that is happening is also important. Understanding how to actually target and talk to them is also important. But also for them, they need to be educated a bit more. The government has done things that try their best to kind of enhance their livelihoods. And looking not just on just one specific demographic, but youth, we have urban youth, rural youth that has different kind of aspirations, different kind of problems. So it's complex, but there's an effort that's being made. It's just that, of course, there are things that are very idealistic in nature. Like, for example, throughout last year, we've seen a lot of youth-related movements, Lawan, Kerajaan Gagal, Bendera Putih, Bendera Hitam, largely driven by youth. They're very energetic, very passionate. That whole power and dedication and determination on the streets, these political parties, every one of them, whoever is in the government, who is not also, would like to translate this into the governing process. But that connection is not happening because we're not talking with the right language to the right people. Muda is doing something good in terms of driving this traction. We are still yet to see how they can then use their primary influence to bring that into the whole governing process. But it's interesting to see like this
right.
time of age.
It used to be that young people were mobilized in large part to help the older folk win power, right? So
yeah.
you get young people to hang your flags, you get young people to do all kinds of kind of menial jobs, but you're not taking them as a partner in a conversation about governance, right? So that's perhaps what is potentially changing. And I say potentially because I think we all assume that looking at the facts, including the ability for 18-year-olds to 21-year-olds now to vote, that it necessarily means something. Mm. But really, we need data to be sure that's true. And that's why I want to ask you, what kind of data are you mining and how are you putting it together so that we're not just speculating or making, projecting our desires onto the world, but actually talking from the basis of some commonly shared facts about what is actually out there in the world?
Yeah, so we mine data two ways, especially, I mean, we have the tools to mine social media data that looks not just primarily on the keywords or the language that's been used or the context of the discussion on social media, but also on the behavior, the background, the affinity and the democratic alignment of each individual core characters that we mine. But also we marry that to more structural data. So we do have like commissioned a few surveys on the ground to just read a bit, get a bit of a ground feel and see what are the current sentiments. Of course, things that are very popular and very obvious, those are things that we might put at the back burner or maybe just use as something that we know is going to be very trivial and obsolete. But like if we talk about sentiment, a lot of studies, and I don't mean to demean anyone, this is a caveat, I'm just saying that from my perspective is if we ask someone whether they're happy or not, they could be very happy, they could be very unhappy. But what's more important is whether that is important to them or not. That's that other axis that's more or less been glossed over.
Right.
So like I read a lot about all of these studies being commissioned saying that they are very happy with this person or very happy with this policy. But whether it matters or not, that needs to be studied. That explication is something that we do using our data to how best suit that particular narrative. And we know that in 5 years' time, this might change. But it doesn't necessarily mean that this data is obsolete. It just means that there's another trend that might be picked up that we can actually use back this particular data. And it's also important to see that the winds of change changes a lot. If we look at US, Bernie Sanders, he latched onto this group of people more than Hillary and Trump combined, the number that he had just in the Democratic primaries, you know. So how he got that is because he remained steadfast to this socialist narrative throughout his political career. And just at this right time, whatever that he said resonates with the needs of that generation. And this might happen here. We don't know when, but it could be triggered by all of what I said just now, the government, the governance issues that's been translated into a lot more unhappiness that later on are not specifically targeted, but someone's been talking about it, that person would actually be able to kind of like influence these people.
So this is fascinating because you're right. I mean, opinion polls are merely opinions. They don't necessarily tell you the behavior that might come out of it, right? So, so you have the attitudes there and it's a snapshot in time. We know that these sentiments that we have are dynamic often. And so the question then becomes, okay, you get a sense of the sentiment, but in terms of generating policies, do you need to do more than just sentiment studies? I mean, what exactly is needed from a point of view of somebody doing research on young people to actually make that analysis holistic or comprehensive?
So in terms of policy, it's not just the young people that's involved in deriving whatever best policy. What it does is it looks at every generational needs based on its trend. It's called worm theory. So generation, the baby boomers, they still have their own needs and aspirations, perhaps something that's related to retirement now. Or maybe, you know, post-recovery or you know, old age, golden age kind of need. And then generation X. So like 10 years down the road, what are their different aspirations? It's not going to be, it's perhaps housing. And then Generation Y, Generation Z. So, and then the millennials. But the topical discourse would great divide between different generations, and understanding this would give you that sense of magnitude, which one needs to be emphasized a bit more. You know, so, and then it can't be just solely on one set of data. You need to really understand then the ground sentiment, the demography, and then the movement of people to people. Because, you know, the more you open your borders and the more that the lines between each individual state or each individual borders are blurred, then there will be a lot more mishmash in terms of, you know, and understanding the nuances of this place compared to the neighboring cities.
As right. Well. So, Cheryl, I mean, very quickly, before we go to a break, is Johor unique in any way, or is it, you know, will the youth demographic here reflect the youth demographic for much of the peninsula, at least?
Okay. You see, Johor is unique in a lot of ways. One, you look at it geographically. Of course, it's neighboring Singapore. Everyone knows that is the biggest thing. But Johor is also the interchange between the west and the east waterways. They have two international level ports to serve this. So there's a huge economic opportunities that's supposed to be booming and providing that much economic security to people. And then it's also like surrounded by waters. It's essentially a maritime state. So there's a lot of opportunities yet to be tapped. You know, even something that can easily bridge the gap between rural and urban just by the economic imperatives. But not to say that no one has done much. It's just that the exploration of this needs to be tapped a lot more because it's there just by geography. So that's what differs Johor by itself. But when you look at it, right, you look at all of these opportunities and you look at the numbers. In 2021, Johor's unemployment rate remained high at 3.8, 3.9%. 3.9 at first quarter, 3.8, and then 4.0. High. National average is 3.2, if I'm not mistaken. So it's higher than national average. And then the more importantly is the skilled-based underemployment. These are people who are skilled, who are supposed to be unemployed with a specific skill set, you know, that matches whatever qualification that they have. 37.7% of them are underemployed. That's huge. So that's people within the workforce. Outside of it, there's like a whole lot more people who are unemployed, who opted for gig economy, and they have no certainty over their future. Because gig economy is, yeah, it's a flourishing industry, but it's not supposed to be like the end of the world for you or any person. Of course, the government could say they will provide some kind of social protection, but it cannot be the end of the road, you know, so especially for the youth. So, I mean, that's just looking at how we can actually bridge these two things together.
Right, okay, wonderful kind of sets up for the next part of our conversation. Sure. We'll take a short break. We'll be back with more on Consider This. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, senior fellow at Bait Al Amanah think tank, Cheryl Sabaruddin. We're talking about young people in Johor and policy formulation that will be both evidence-based and effective for any government that Johor has. So you paint a very interesting picture of elite skills that are available in that demographic. Underemployment, I think the DOS has recently released some statistics on underemployment. It's huge. It's over 2 million, I think, nationwide. But when it comes to young people, and you just made that argument that the gig economy shouldn't be something for the long term. It's temporary work. It's supposed to fill up your free time. It does a lot of things, but it isn't supposed to mimic permanent employment, right? But is that what's in the mind of young people? Because a lot of people say that there's a generation that likes that ultra flexibility. Yes, it's precarious, but it gives them a certain type of freedom. It might not be wise, looking at it from a different perspective, but maybe that's what they want. Or am I incorrect? Is it just that's what is available to them? And that's why many of them in the gig economy.
I think it's because it's currently that what's available for them, but after being in it for a while, it becomes what they're used to. It's like as if that's the only way that they can actually make money. They're happy with it. They're kind of like, you know, they feel like that's how, you know, they don't like blue collar, white collar work anymore. like schedules. And of course, we know that the workforce has been disrupted. People are working anywhere nowadays. Digital nomad is becoming a real thing. So that, not to say that we need to kind of like paint that kind of very daunting picture in terms of how to move them from there to what we aspire them to be. But after a while, wisdom will kick in. They will realize after they get like one or two kids that they cannot live like this forever. How are they going to paint a future, or how are they going to tell their kids later to grow and be someone if they can't even show that kind of example? Of course, this will come. But during that time, whether it's too late or not, that might be the biggest question then. But that's why the government, anyone who's in the government, needs to then make sure that these people are taken care of, at least understand that there's an opportunity to get something much more worthwhile. But also, not discounting the fact that they still need to be socially protected. Social protection is important. But of course, like I said, gig economy is just something that's supposed to be there to help cushion the impact of lifestyle a bit before they go something
more. I know there was a recent video in which somebody made pretty much that argument, but was criticized quite heavily. Yeah. Or there seemed to be very mixed responses from somebody from a different generation saying, well, actually, you shouldn't be relying on this kind of casual work as a long-term plan. So this comes back to sentiment and also what's in the minds of young people in terms of not just what they want or what they see is available, but how they might think about renegotiating their position. Because what is the leverage for young people now? Do they have the skills? Do they have quality education? Things that maybe are entry points for the state. The state can address issues, say, of education, of skills, upskilling, and also the creation of education that's of value, that, you know, credentials that are of value. Is that something you can match between sentiment and policy?
Sentiment becomes very simplified in that sense. Because I saw this video. Even Datuk Hasni, the current Menteri Besar of Johor at that time, he also said the same thing. And there was a lot of mixed reactions. But if you sift through social media, these comments are from people who are that ignorant to what he actually wanted to say, the real picture. Just the headline sounds like as if he's ignorant. You know, because I don't know how the nature of the headline was done, but essentially that was how they read it, and that's how they argued their point of view.
Right, it was like dismissing gig
dismissing
work.
Dismissing it, and not they see him as dismissing gig work, right. But he's trying to say that, yeah, we'll provide you social work, that cannot be the end of the road for you. But they'll be like, this is a baby boomer, doesn't understand, you know, disruption and stuff like that. Well, the fact is, disruption doesn't mean that you're working like that. Disruption also means that you find a solution within the ecosystem that you're living in to provide a solution that can be sold, and you make take a shot at a better life. So that is essentially lost in the narrative, lost in whatever, because it's not being communicated. But there are people trying to advocate, trying to, you know, correct that kind of misperceptions. But, you know, these are just people who are loud. But there are a lot more people who are silent out there, who reads through it, who might still have that kind of same understanding. And we have no idea the quantity of these people.
Okay. I do want to ask you, though, you know, when you look at the behavior of political parties, they often do things because they anticipate that this is what, say, young people, for instance, want. So they will have a pesta, they will have entertainment. Yeah. They might organize one or two webinars or talks about serious matters like employment and so on. But they kind of assume that what young people want is the entertainment. But what do we know about young people and their political commitments or their willingness to invest in thinking about issues that have a direct impact on their future?
Okay, well, there's no empirical number yet. I mean, as far as this recording is done, to give us that indication of numbers. But I know one thing, though. The block of votes that we're looking at is 18 to 20 years old. Not just in Johor, but nationally, it's not a monolith. It's a smaller reflection of the larger society. There's going to be a huge number there who are still ignorant to the entire democratic process and how they, by them participating, can make a difference, and how they, by participating, means that their share of voice matters. That is something that I think most political parties struggle to look at and understand. Muda is positioning themselves as one because of the personality of the political leaders. But like I said, when I talked about Bernie Sanders, personality doesn't matter so much. It matters whether you speak to what they want to listen to. So that is a matter of time whether any one of these political parties latch on to that particular moment in time that resonates with the larger needs of the people. But until now, I don't think that there's much numbers or much data to support what the reality is right now.
I want to ask you, in your work in trying to get this data, has anything surprised you in your study of young people?
There is one thing that surprised me. This was before GE14. We did a study all over Johor, and one specific study for every Felda in Johor, not just Johor, Felda in Pahang, Felda in Negeri Sembilan. Just one particular aspect kind of like has a huge dichotomy between the both of them. This is within the young. We talk about foreign pendatang asing, foreigners. A lot of areas, especially in the urban areas, they have this hostility. They hate, they don't like seeing foreigners opening shops or just being present, you know, because of security issues, because of all of these stigmas, you know, this association between us. But in Feldas, it's a total different perspective. They would rather have a lot more foreign people because they help with the harvest. The more foreigners exist within their compounds or somewhere within the vicinity, the more they will actually reap the harvest. So there are things like that, that if, let's say, we talk about one specific issue, it might just like be totally a double-edged sword when you go somewhere else. So that's one. I mean, a few more other things. In Johor specifically, that was like foreign. That time, there was this huge issue of 1MDB and stuff like that. It wasn't that high as compared to foreign ownership. So when Pakatan Harapan during PRD14 came and talked a lot about Forest City and then the danger of Chinese ownership and stuff, that resonates, that really hit the right pulse compared to the other issues in the national compendium. So some of it, those are just to name a few.
You know, I think at the end of the day, what we hope the young people do is the future, right? So I don't know if there's enough evidence about what they think the future is, because they've had, over the last 3 years, not just political volatility back home, they've seen a global pandemic, they've seen the causeway shut for the first time in generations, or maybe ever. And then now, you know, we are also looking at a war in Europe. Are they pessimistic or optimistic about the future? And how will that sentiment, optimism or pessimism, drive their willingness to participate fully, to be enthusiastic about work and the economy and upskilling themselves?
I think right now, the biggest notion or the biggest thing that's resonating among the people, especially in this environment right now, talking about elections and perhaps another general election coming soon, is the big deficit of trust with government, whoever in the government. It's just natural, you know. So because of the Banjir fiasco, they started to have that system of self-government where people help themselves, largely driven by youth activists. And, you know, Muda was there. Muda had a swath of volunteers. I had even people who joined some of my staff. And they said that most of these youth don't really recognize or identify themselves as a political group. Not very much, you know, politically driven. It's because it's a platform for them to help. So activism in this sort is something that I take pride of, knowing that, you know, our generation at least has that kind of sense of altruism. Just that, you know, there's a specific political party that right now resonates with them because they speak louder in their domain. So putting politics aside, at least we know, we have faith that there are these sense of, you know, personal choices that they take by themselves to help people who are in trouble with no sense of gratification at all. That's good. But then, whether this, and the larger question, would then give, you know, a positive feeling towards them themselves, you know, as individuals, as whether they can actually have a good shot in their life in the future. That, so far, because it hasn't actually reached that moment yet. And I think because none of these parties are yet in government, as we speak. So if there is, perhaps there would be, you know, like a different kind of discourse, a different kind of conversation might take place. But until then, I think right now it's just noise, very loud, white noise on social media. But whether or not that would necessitate any action or not, that one is still yet to be seen.
Right. Fascinating, Cheryl. Yeah. I wish we had more time to get into this issue, because I think there's so many important challenges that are refracted to the youth demographic. Thank you again for being on the show.
Yeah.
I've been speaking to Cheryl Sabaruddin. He's senior fellow at Bait Al-Amanah think tank here in Johor Bahru. That's all we have for Consider This. I'm Sharaj Patton, only on Astro 1.